In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about reform of agricultural trade. We certainly know that in the future, demand for food is going to grow. And we expect that as that happens, more of the world's food production is expected to move through world trade. Now, depending upon who you ask, you're going to get a different take on this. People with the World Bank, for example, say that if we could remove barriers to trade, that would be a good thing. It would boost the world economy, and it would take a lot of people out of poverty. However, there are other people who don't see it that way. They say that, in fact, more liberal trade policies work the opposite way. And what has happened so far is that liberalizing trade has mostly benefited big farmers and multinational corporations, and, in fact, rural poverty has increased. So we'll see if we can sort some of this out today with a guest that we have here in the studio. His name is Robert Thompson. He is recently retired from the World Bank, where he served as director and senior advisor for rural development and also senior advisor on agricultural trade policy. He's chairman of the International Policy Council on Agriculture, Food, and Trade. He joined the World Bank in 1998 and before that served as president and CEO of the Winrock International Institute for Agricultural Development. And then before that, he was at Purdue, where he in fact got his PhD. He was dean of agriculture and professor of agricultural economics at Purdue. And then before that, served as assistant secretary for economics at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And he's here visiting the campus, going to be giving a talk. This is sponsored by the folks in ACES, College of Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental. What's the S stand for? Sciences? Mm-hmm. Okay. See, my apology to the folks at ACES. I always sort of use just the initials, and somebody says, now, what does that stand for? And I actually have to think about it for a little while. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk on this very subject today, and we're pleased that he could here be with us and talk about this very topic. So questions, comments are welcome, as always. If people would like to participate in the conversation, all they need to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. That number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll free 800-222-9455. So at any point here you want to give us a call, you can do that, and I know he'll do his best to respond. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Just to start off with a few kind of givens, and then we can go on and we can talk about trade. I guess as a given, we have to say, first of all, over the next few decades, we have every reason to believe that the population of the world is going to continue to increase, and that's going to increase demand for food. And I think we have the expectation that less developed countries will develop, and as people get more money to spend and get a little bit beyond just subsistence, that's also going to increase demand for food. So certainly we know there's at least two things that in the future is and if nothing else, is because of increase in population, the demand for food is going to go up.
Yeah. That's right. We're expecting population to grow from about 6 billion at the turn of this century to about 9.1 billion by the middle of the century. So that's a little over half. And there are about 1.25 billion people in the world who are living on less than a dollar a day. 800 million of them go to bed hungry. And that's the group of people that can't even get access to a decent diet today. And as they get additional purchasing power, they're going to eat more animal protein, more fruits and vegetables, more edible oils. And I see the demand for food doubling, with about half coming from population growth and half coming from income growth by the middle of the century.
Okay. So we know that that's going to happen. Demand is definitely going up. And I think something else that we know for certain is that if you look around the world, look at land that's in production now, we pretty much, the land that's really there and available for sustainable production, if we take the stuff that's really marginal out of there, it is not the case that there's a lot of land around sitting waiting. We're pretty much using all the land that there is to use.
That's right. We know that there's degradation of land going on around the world. There's also a lot of land being paved over as cities grow and as we build roads around the world. So therefore, at most, we can't count on even maintaining the current land area in production. But according to the FAO, there's at most 12% more land that could be brought into production without cutting trees, land that's reasonably fertile. But if we double food production by doubling the number of acres under cultivation, we'll have massive destruction of wildlife habitat, reduce biodiversity, lose carbon sequestration capacity, and as a result, we'll have totally unacceptable environmental outcomes. So therefore, we have to double food production on not much more land.
Yeah. This is... in a sense, maybe we're going in the direction of a different kind of, you don't have to worry about it, a different conversation, but I guess I do want to at least touch on this point, and that is, do we expect, when we look at agriculture around the world, particularly places where there's basically subsistence agriculture, or people are growing things basically to feed themselves, and if they have some left over, well, then they're going to sell it, that what's going to happen, what's going to end up happening in the rest of the world is what we here probably saw 100 years ago happen. And that is there will be fewer people farming, they will be farming bigger farms, and in order to meet demand, what's going to have to happen is that whatever is the most current cutting-edge technologies are going to have to be applied to that, because otherwise there's no way to meet the demand that we know we're going to have.
That's absolutely right. We're going to have to double productivity on the land that we have in production, and probably even more challenging is going to be the problem of water, because farmers are already using 70% of the water, or the fresh water in the world, and with urbanization going on at the rate it is around the world, cities are going to outbid farmers for the available water. And so farmers are going to have to figure out how to more than double crop per drop, or the average productivity of the water they're using.
So then we've taken a little walk here to get to the point of trade, but here now I guess we do indeed come to the issue of trade, because given all of that, we know that in individual places, they're simply not going to be able to produce for themselves to meet their demand. So essentially what that means is that there's going to have to, if that demand, that global demand is going to be met, then there's going to have to be a lot of food going to other places from the place that it's produced.
That's right. In Asia, there's less than 1 acre of good farmland available per person farming. And there's no way you can lift all those farmers out of poverty on 1 acre. In fact, the only thing you can grow on 1 acre of land that and generate enough cash income and lift a family out of poverty is drugs. And obviously, we're not in the business of promoting that, but there's simply nothing else that's high enough value per acre. So you just can't grow enough in Asia on that limited amount of land to feed its huge population. And as incomes grow and population continues to grow, you just can't reach any conclusion but that Asia is going to be a much, much larger importer of grains. Mm-hmm. They may very well try to grow more fruits and vegetables, even for export, in order to get the maximum value out of each acre of land that they have in production. But that means a bigger market for us for corn and for beans and for wheat, for that matter.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Robert Thompson. He is now the chairman of the International Food and Agricultural Trade Policy Council. He was for a while at the World Bank and just fairly recently retired from the World Bank. He was the director and senior advisor for rural development and also senior advisor for agricultural trade policy. He's here to give a talk on the U of I campus. It's a part of a series of lectures on global food security sponsored by ACES Global Connect. That's the international arm of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. My apologies to the ACES folks for not coming up with that right away. He's going to be giving a talk this afternoon at 2 on the U of I campus. He's here visiting with us to talk about some of the same subject matter. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, again, here now, I guess now we've come to the issue of trade. And it seems that the difficulty here is that there are a number of competing interests. We have interests of larger industrial countries and the ones that are developing. And we have interests of big farmers and big agribusiness, and we have interested small farmers. And so it seems that the issue is it possible to come up with a policy that's going to make everybody happy, that's going to feed people, that won't hurt small farmers, will satisfy the need for food, will also satisfy governments who are interested in protecting their own producers. So there we get into the whole issue of tariffs and subsidies and so forth. I mean, how does one work out a policy that makes everybody happy, or is that even possible?
No, you can't make everybody happy. In every country, there are more and less efficient producers of different products. And in some countries, farmers who produce certain products less than others can produce them efficiently have been protected by high subsidies, and as a result, you've distorted what's produced where. But any time you liberalize trade, you're going to have gainers and losers. I mean, this is something that economists don't talk about often enough. Economists always talk about the gains from trade. And it's reasonable to expect that net, the gains exceed the losses, and therefore society as a whole ends up better off. But if it turns out, as many of the NGOs have asserted, that the losers are the already lowest income members of society, some of this one and a quarter billion people that live on less than a dollar a day, then if you're opening up agricultural imports and those farmers are not prepared to be able to compete, you may very well cause an increase in poverty. But there's no reason that that's necessarily the outcome. Mm-hmm. We give a lot of foreign aid. We and all the other rich countries of the world, the World Bank lends on very favorable terms. And if those countries are using those resources appropriately to target low-income people, like building rural roads, doing agriculture research to raise productivity in agriculture, creating the enabling environment for investors to create non-farm employment in rural areas so smallholders that can't get a hold of more land can at least supplement what they earn in agriculture from non-farm sources, then there's no reason not to expect that opening up trade can help everybody. Some may gain relatively more than others, but everybody can benefit, but it doesn't happen automatically.
Well, let me ask you about this basic sort of conflict in the way people see this issue of trade liberalization, because as I said at the beginning, and as you touch on, if you take, for example, take an organization like the World Bank, they will make this argument that says, look, taking down trade barriers is a good thing. It's a good thing for everybody. It will, generally speaking, boost. It's good for the world economy, and that it's also good for some of the poorest people in the world. And then other organizations and non-governmental organizations that are concerned with food and agriculture policy will look at that and they will say the exact opposite. They will say, well, no, Mr. World Bank, in fact, it's not like that at all. And as I said, they will make this argument that says, well, what happens when you liberalize trade is that indeed, yeah, it's good for big producers, it's good for agribusiness, maybe it's good for the big industrialized countries who are doing well already, but in fact, it's going to have the opposite effect, particularly on poor farmers, and it's going to make poorer people poorer. Now, do you think that in fact one or the other of those perspectives is correct, or is there some way in which both sides are right?
Well, for the first thing, many of the NGOs talk about the liberalization of agricultural trade that's already occurred hurting farmers in the developing world. The reality is that we got virtually no liberalization of agricultural trade out of the last trade round, or the so-called Uruguay round agreement in agriculture. So it's inappropriate to attribute any deterioration in the conditions of low-income farmers in low-income countries in the last 5 years to the outcome of the trade negotiations, because we really didn't get much trade liberalization. But that said, we know that those countries that have followed a more open trading system have benefited in the form of faster economic growth than countries that haven't. And so in that sense, I'd say the World Bank and IMF are right. Where they both, I think, misled people, or went astray, is by the failure to admit that there are gainers and there are losers anytime you liberalize trade. If the losers are the most politically powerful people who are benefiting from protectionism now, like sugar growers in most every high-income country, dairy farmers in most countries, cotton producers, rice growers, and those people wouldn't have the subsidies if they weren't politically powerful. And so they're going to be losers if you liberalize trade, and they may be powerful enough to block any liberalization agreement that might come along. In the case of the developing countries, as I suggested before, if the people that get hurt are low-income farmers who are already at the bottom of the social ladder, then it's simply unjust. If they're living on less than a dollar a day already and you knock them down even further. So that's why you really need to focus on making the investments in the enabling environment, the infrastructure, the education, the healthcare, the securing clear title to farmland so that farmers can pledge it as collateral against loans, that they can transfer ownership of their property when they want to, that contracts are honored, and there's a judiciary to enforce that. And if you have these components of an enabling environment in place, then the private sector will create the jobs off the farm, as well as in food processing and adding value to the raw products of the land. And you get the economic engine moving, and it accelerates faster and faster. But it isn't going to happen without government intervention in the form of investments in roads and in schools and healthcare facilities.
Mm. But just going back to what we were talking about earlier, it sounds as if we sort of made this point, but you're saying that what is going to have to happen in developing countries is that it's going to be the same thing that happened here. It's inevitable. People are going to have to move off the farm. Everyone's not going to be able to make their living that way. And even as we see here in the United States, people who do, who are involved in agriculture are going to have to come up with ways to generate off farm income, which we see here too. Yeah. So those kind of trends just seem to be inevitable.
Every country that solved the problem of rural poverty has done it by turning most of their small farmers into part-time farmers. Mm. Most people don't realize it, but 75% of the people we count as farmers in the United States earn most of their family income from off the farm. In Germany, before reunification, it was 80%. In Japan, it's 90%. And so if all of these countries haven't been able to do it, there's no way countries like India and China are going to be able to when they've got less than 1 acre of land available per person in agriculture. You just can't grow enough of anything that's legal on that amount of land and feed a family and lift it out of poverty. So the most important things for those governments to be doing is to so that they don't end up with everybody moving into the big cities that are already overflowing, is to create an enabling environment so that jobs get created in the small cities and market towns widely dispersed through the country. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got great cities like Wichita and St. Louis and Minneapolis and Denver and Kansas City widespread through the countryside. And as a result, each of them is a pole of development. They're all well linked with one another through good interstate highways, rail links, and so on. And that's the kind of thing that has to happen in developing countries. Otherwise, you end up with places that are just impossible to live in, like Calcutta and Lagos and Mexico City.
Yeah. I'm sure that there are people around the world who cast their eyes on countries like the United States, but not just the United States, and I'm going back to this issue of subsidies and protectionist kind of policy, who would say that, it's well and good for countries like you to talk about free trade, but the fact of the matter is that you do subsidize some of your growers, and you do have, restrictions on what can come into the United States in order to benefit your own producers. So I guess that gets at this question, just how committed are we to this idea of liberalizing trade and given the fact that there are within American politics some groups who have a lot of clout, whether it's possible that we're really going to see any change. And I suppose one would have to start out admitting, this is the kind of thing that you're not going to change overnight. This is going to take some time. But one wonders whether you're going to see substantial change at all.
Well, I think we'll see change after 2005. I think the federal budget deficit is going to reach such crisis proportions by the time we do the budget reconciliation package in 2005, after the next presidential election. Neither party is going to admit to the problem before the presidential election. But I really believe that things like the 2002 Farm Bill are going to have to be revisited, especially in an environment where you have a lot of urban residents who see the editorials and papers about fat cat farmers getting big subsidies, sugar growers, and so on. And therefore, there's going to be a backlash against the 2002 Farm Bill. Also, passing the 2002 Farm Bill reversed the United States move towards freer and more open agricultural policy 180 degrees. We, together with countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, were leading the charge towards opening up agricultural markets through the last round of trade negotiations. But we really reversed course in the 2002 Farm Bill and went backwards in the manner in which we raised our subsidies. And in fact, it really concerns me when I talk to soybean growers, for example, the extent to which they've lost confidence in the ability of the United States to compete. We sell a third of everything we grow overseas. If we can't maintain that volume of exports or increase it, there's no growth out there in the market for this for our agriculture productive capacity. I believe there's going to be plenty of market there for both Brazil, Argentina, and the United States in, say, in the corn and bean market as we go into the first decades of this century. But that's a long way of saying that agriculture policy, as followed by the U.S. in the last couple of years, has really reduced our credibility as an advocate for freer trade. But I do believe that after 2005, when we have to fix the budget deficit, that this will be the propitious time for the United States to really engage in the trade negotiations.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because I certainly think back to the discussions in Washington. The last time around, there was talk about farm legislation. And going into that, we had a lot of people in Congress saying things like, it is now time for there to be a fundamental rethinking of agricultural policy in this country for a variety of reasons, economic reasons, environmental reasons, and so forth. And there were people who were talking pretty big about changing things. And at the end of the day, when the dust settled, things didn't change at all, which I suppose, again, is an indicator of the kind of political power that agriculture and agribusiness has in the United States. But it's so, though, you think maybe we might actually, next time around we come to do this, that that both political and environmental pressures will be enough to get past the point of saying, yes, we're going to do something revolutionary and actually doing it.
I think we'll have to. The budget deficit is not going to be sustainable by 2005. This war in Iraq, if nothing else, is costing us such a fortune that other things are going to have to give. And older Americans want drug benefits or prescription drug benefits in their Medicare programs. And that's going to be such a high priority, and it's going to be expensive, that some other things are going to have to give, that you can't just keep piling on federal expenditures. So that, I believe, will bring about some change. What worries me is that virtually all of these big government checks are being capitalized into the value of farmland. During the first half of the 1980s, the price of land fell 60% in the corn and wheat growing areas of U.S. agriculture. We had record number of farm and rural bank bankruptcies in the post-depression period. And we got land prices down about middle of the 80s to where you could make a buck in agriculture, that you could get a return on your investment in farmland. But it's very worrisome the extent to which we've bid land prices right back up to probably double what you can possibly cash flow on any reasonable expected world market prices. And so we've set ourselves up as a result of these big government checks for another drop in land prices come sometime after we reform agriculture policy, because the basis for sustaining these high prices will be knocked out from under them. you know, we had $5 billion a year for 5 years leading up to the 2002 Farm Bill in emergency appropriations because of the supposed financial crisis in agriculture. But yet land prices were being bid up 4% per year during that time. Something doesn't calculate. Mm-hmm. I mean, if agriculture is so unprofitable that nobody's making any money, you're certainly not bidding up the price of the most value or the most important input or asset in farm production. But the basic reason for that was the $5 billion checks were all being bid into the price of land. And so I really believe we've set ourselves up for another fall like the early 1980s. People who don't have any debt on the land will feel poor. Their asset or their net worth won't look as nice. But they won't be knocked out of production. The people who really be hurt are the recent entrants, the really bright, young, aggressive people who've gotten out of college, gotten into farming, and borrowed themselves up to the hilt. And if the same thing happens as happened in the early 1980s, with land prices dropping to the point that the size of the loan outstanding exceeds the value of the collateral, then the banks will get in the picture and call the loans. But that's probably my biggest worry about the present farm policies. They're undercutting our international competitiveness by raising the total cost of production because of the more expensive land, and they're setting us up for another fall. And anybody that remembers the first half of the 1980s doesn't want to relive that.
Yeah. Well, we talked earlier about the fact that here we've seen, certainly we have seen this demographic trend in the United States over the last century or something, maybe a little bit more than that, of a sort of reversal, major reversal of where people live, shift from rural to urban, and fewer and fewer people being involved in farming. So we've got fewer people producing the food and fewer people producing more food, and that's a trend that we're likely to see elsewhere around the world too. What we've seen over that time also, because of what's happened with the prices, getting to the point where to make a living, you gotta have the biggest operation you possibly can. You gotta be as efficient as you can. You gotta have as much land as it's possible to have. And I know a lot of people are kind of unhappy about that development. And when one might make the argument that says, well, that's just the way things are, that's inevitable. And other people would say, well, it's not exactly inevitable because we've adopted policies that have actually pushed in us in that direction. And I guess maybe this is kind of a philosophical question about whether, in fact, it was a mistake that we could have done something to slow down that trend a little bit in agriculture, and then maybe it wasn't such a good thing. And then of course the companion question is, well, even if you think that that's right, is there anything that can be done about that now, or is that just at this point, or we just have to say, well, that is the way that it is, and that's the way that it's going to be?
Well, I'm the product of a small family dairy farm, so I have personal experience in this question. But I think a very strong case can be made that the way we've practiced farm policy in the United States has contributed to faster consolidation, because the way we've practiced farm policies, we've distributed the benefits in proportion to sales. This means that the largest farmers get the most benefits, mm-hmm. and this gives them the additional liquidity to buy up their neighbors' farms. And so if anything, practicing policies of the nature we have or in the manner we have has reinforced the tendency towards consolidation. Farm organizations defend farm policies every time they go to Congress for a new farm bill on the basis of low farm family income. But the reality is what they lobby for are policies that provide most of the benefits to the already largest and wealthiest farmers. And then they get even wealthier and buy up their neighbors and accelerate the consolidation. So I think if we hadn't run our farm policies in the manner we had, we wouldn't have had as rapid consolidation. But I still think we'd have had consolidation. I think the key thing is to make sure that we have the infrastructure in place to make small cities and market towns attractive places for investors to create jobs off the farm, so we keep those communities viable. If a community is solely based on agriculture and you have consolidation of agribusiness as well as of the farms, a lot of those communities dry up and blow away. So we need to, I think the one thing we can do to keep them viable is an active rural development policy that stimulates creation of greater non-farm employment throughout rural America. And farm policy is traditionally practiced in this country is not good rural development policy.
Yeah. Well, certainly there are different farm organizations. I'm not going to name any names, but there are different farm organizations, and they have different kind of priorities. There have been some, and you know, particularly we started to see a lot of people making these arguments back in the 80s when things were really bad, saying, look, we got a problem here, and that if we allow smaller farmers and smaller operations to go out of business and continue to see this sort of consolidation and continue to see this trend that says you've got to be as big as you possibly can be to survive, so that, you know, we're not going to have small farmers anymore, and maybe we're not going to have median farmers anymore. And then we talk about production of animals, livestock, you might as well forget it, unless you're some kind of mega operation. You know, there were people in some farm organizations saying, look, this is a problem, it's going on, and if we allow this to continue, one day we're going to wake up and say, we've lost something. You know, some of those folks were quite vocal. Mm-hmm. I guess in the long run, maybe they weren't, you know, they didn't have the clout that some others did, but at least there were people making that, you know, making that argument. Did they just not have the strength to move policy in the direction that they wanted?
I think a lot of those people who were making those arguments were probably less than were often less good managers than of the larger units, or some of the larger, better managed farm operations. Every farm has a different level of productivity and different cost of production, and frequently there are economies of size in farm production. To efficiently use one complement of the state-of-the-art machinery we have today in corn and bean production takes about 2,500 acres. If you have that equipment and you don't run it over that much land, you're not spreading the capital cost of that equipment over enough units of product to be competitive. So it's in part that our technologies are not scale neutral, that they tend to favor larger than average farms. We also have to remember that that there are different stages of adoption of the available technologies, and that as you increase productivity, it reduces the unit cost of production. But the early adopters of the technology tend to benefit from that lower cost of production. When a significant fraction of the farmers adopt the technology, market prices fall closer to that cost of production, and then the laggards either are forced out or forced to adopt the technology. And so as a result, as in effect, the profit margin gets skinnier and skinnier for the laggards in adopting the higher productivity technologies, you find people driven to larger size just to provide a comparable level of income to the labor and management skills of the farmer involved. Not all farmers have the same cost of production. And there's a fallacy when we talk about the cost of production, because really no two farmers have the same cost of production. So I think the desire for parity of income with people in the rest of the economy when potential profit margins are so skinny really has been one of the principal sources driving people towards larger size. So I think in many ways some of those organizations in the late 80s were leaning against a wind that they
that was inevitably going to keep increasing the average size of the farm.
We are got about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Robert Thompson. He's chairman of the International Food and Agricultural Trade Policy Council. He is fairly recently retired from the World Bank. He served there as director and senior advisor for rural development and also senior advisor for agricultural trade policy. He's been involved in agricultural economic issues one way or another for a long time. He served as dean of agriculture at professor of agricultural economics at Purdue, and also going back a little bit further than that, was a senior staff economist for food and agriculture at the President's Council of Economic Advisors. He was also assistant secretary for economics at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he's here to talk about agricultural trade and reform of agricultural trade. It's part of a series of public lectures on global food security sponsored by the ACES Global Connect. That's the international arm of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. And he'll be talking on the U of I campus this afternoon. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here lined up, ready to go, starting with Champaign County and line one. Hello.
Good morning. I wanted to, the last subject you were talking about, I have opinions on, but that's got to do with higher productivity agriculture sometimes requires so much higher input that in lesser developed countries it's just not feasible to do. And then a lot of the Green Revolution, too, have been disastrous from that point of view and from others. But what I really promoted me my call was earlier you saying that NGOs have had some points to make, but that they, one of the problems you saw was that they couldn't argue that trade liberalization has bad effects because it's never been tried. Well, it's never been done through a multilateral unit, so we still have our high subsidies, but the IMF and the World Bank, mainly the IMF, through loan and imposing structural adjustment policies at, because of the debt, has imposed lots of forms of trade liberalization unilaterally, and they're only mostly one way, and there is a track record on that, and it is enhancing poverty as opposed to poverty alleviation. So there is, it's not true that there's not a track record on so-called liberalization. Now, you can say, well, you agree that it should be done multilaterally and that we have, it's unfair the way it's been done, so it can't really be called economic liberalization. But this is what is being called economic liberalization, and this is what is being imposed, and this is what is, making the plight of people in lesser developed countries even worse. And I think farmers here should see that commonality they have, actually, as opposed to in any kind of nativist response, but that's another subject, perhaps. What do you say about structural adjustment and that facet and that kind of track record on so-called economic liberalization?
The first reaction is that I think both the World Bank and the IMF have acknowledged that they made some significant mistakes in structural adjustment, that whereas they argued that when you liberalize an economy, the gains of the gainers exceed the losses of the losers, and therefore society as a whole ends up better off, they didn't pay much attention to who the losers were. They didn't have adjustment assistance, retraining, the programs. The majority of the poverty is in rural areas, yet the bulk of the World Bank lending is targeted at urban problems. And so I think the bank, I would certainly argue, and the bank would admit today, that they made mistakes, but they're trying to do a lot better with a lot more pro-poor policies or development policies. I was brought into the bank from outside to lead a review and revision of the rural development strategy because the bank accepts poverty reduction as job one. We know that 70% of the people that live on less than a dollar a day, and that's a billion and a quarter people, live in rural areas, and most are farmers, but yet the bank had a pronounced urban bias in its lending. So it's trying to move in the direction of more focus on rural poverty,
rural infrastructure, and so on. But I'd like to also go back to one point assertion you made, and that is that the Green Revolution has been a disaster. I just cannot let that go by and unchallenged. I was early in my career involved with the introduction of the first high-yielding rice varieties in Laos and doing farmer field demonstrations under Lao conditions, and showing farmers who had never grown more than 1 ton of rice per hectare, hectare is 2.5 acres, that they could get 5, 6, even 7 tons in that same area of land as they'd never seen 1 ton grow before. This productivity growth had an incredibly positive impact on farmers' net income. Yes, it took more inputs, but the profitability of getting that higher productivity as a result of the lower unit cost of production, not the input cost, but the lower unit cost of production, was such that the farmers would find any way to get the money to buy the fertilizer to put on those seeds. And in fact, they would raid the seed multiplication plots under the dark of night and steal the seed as it was maturing. They were so desirous of getting access to the higher productivity and higher and more profitable varieties.
That's just one facet. A lot of things, the vitamin A rice and all that, are touted as being some kind of salvation, whereas we know that there's already enough food in the world to feed the poor and feed the starving, but it's just a matter of distribution and an unfair economic system. So just attaching a technological fix, I think, is entirely inappropriate. And, you know, there are a lot of other factors going on at the time that might have dictated that they needed to you know have this to enhance their production, whereas it may not have been a stable situation. Just as in here, we have overproduction and consequently subsidies, and consequently NAFTA is called trade liberalization, but it obviously isn't really, because we still have our subsidies and it's devastating the Mexican countryside, and then we have to increase border patrols and immigration controls and all the unintended consequences of these phenomena. I think one needs a more holistic point of view, and I think your analysis of the domestic situation, as I've been hearing it, is, and predicting this impending, crash in prices, farm prices again, is probably right on. So I don't disagree with you entirely. But thanks a lot.
All right. You say we've got overproduction today relative to current demand, and there certainly is a great deal of unmet need in the world with 800 million people going hungry. But that's mainly a problem of poverty. The rich in no country go hungry. And it's the poor who don't have the purchasing power, and this is to access the available food supply. So with that, I agree. But don't forget that with the population growth, and if we have any reasonable success in broad-based economic growth in the world, we're likely to see a doubling of food demand in the first half of this century, and that's going to create tremendous market opportunities for efficient producers wherever they are in the world, as long as their own policies don't get in the way of their ability to compete. And I couldn't agree more with you in your statement about the adverse impact of high-income countries' agricultural policies on the poor and low-income countries. We really do mess up the market by depressing world market prices and undercutting the income-earning potential of smallholders in Mexico and all over the world.
We'll try to get one more caller in here real quick. Bloomington, Indiana, line number 2. Hello.
I'll be quick. May I ask how many people we have to feed? What is the world population now?
9.1 billion. Oh. Well, sorry. It's about 6.1 now, and we're going to 9.1 by the middle of the century.
So it's 6.1 and growing.
Yes.
And since we have declining population in Europe, Is that making more farmland in Europe available? And we have the AIDS problem in Africa that is killing millions. Does that also make more farmland available?
This projected increase from 6.1 to 9.1 billion people has already built in a factor taking into account the scourge of AIDS cutting population growth potential. The fact that Europe isn't reproducing itself
Yes, it does increase the available food production capacity, but on the other hand, there are extremely high price supports induced environmentally unsustainable levels of input use. So the European farmers have been the highest chemical appliers per acre in the world, and as a result of reducing the price supports together with their tougher environmental regulations is bringing a reduction in input use and therefore lower productivity, and this is more than offsetting decline in demand in Europe. And as a result, I don't see Europe being as large an exporter in the future as they are today.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, I think that we will have to leave it at that with our thanks to our guest, Robert Thompson. He's chairman of the International Food and Agricultural Trade Policy Council and is former official at the World Bank. He served as director and senior advisor for rural development and also senior advisor for agricultural trade policy. He's here visiting the campus as part of a lecture series sponsored by the ACES Global Connect. That's the international arm of the College of Agricultural Consumer Environmental Sciences here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Thompson.
It's been my pleasure.